everyone, welcome back to the podcast. This is your girl Mo on the Mostable Podcast. For those joining us for the first time, welcome. And to our usual listeners, thank you and welcome back. Today, we are very honored to have Dr. Tracy Bethea. She's a remarkable researcher and assistant professor at the Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. She has devoted her career to addressing the critical issue of cancer health disparities, with a particular focus on improving the lives of African-American women affected by breast cancer. Her research, which is pioneering, by the way, looks into cancer epidemiology, exploring the various subtypes of breast cancer and the unique experiences of marginalized populations. Through her work in large-scale studies, such as the Black Women's Health Studies, she has shed light on the challenges faced by women of color as they navigate their cancer journey from diagnosis to survivorship. And her projects investigate the environmental and socioeconomic factors that contribute to these disparities, really providing a lot of insights that guide the development of more effective solutions. She has become a beacon of hope for countless individuals. She's been supported from a prestigious KO1 award from the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, where she highlights the need to address the medical and social determinants of health. And her passion for empowering women and their families is also evident in her commitment to improving their quality of life and overall health outcomes. So today, we are so honored to have her because she does a lot of work. And as you hear her story, you'll see just what drives her passion. One thing she's also doing that I know is that she's looking at the connection between sleep and health. And her vision is for a future where cancer care is more equitable. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bethea to the podcast. Hello.
I'm glad you're recording this because I need that whole bio. It was so much better than what I write for myself. I need to copy and paste it when I send.
I will send it to you
and everything.
Kudos to my team for helping with that, by the way. So really, really honored to have you here. And I know you have such a remarkable story. But before we get into the thick of it, can you tell us a little bit about your background? And specifically, if there were moments in your childhood growing up that would have really predicted the current path you are on as far as your work and your passion?
I don't know about predicted, but so even in the womb, my mom tells this story of when she was pregnant with me and she was getting ultrasounds. It was so hard for them to tell if I was a boy or a girl because they would move the wand and my little nose or my fingers or something would go to where the wand is. She was like, "You were always nosy. No wonder you became a scientist, because you're just nosy." she's originally from North Carolina. So, you know, it's a different culture there to just be like, "My child is nosy," but now she's a scientist. So I think I've always kind of been curious, always, you know, pushed boundaries a little bit. And I'm grateful my parents, of course, they were old school, so they corrected a lot, but they also encouraged me to challenge myself. I always struggled with science and math, and they didn't accept anything less than what they thought I was capable of, even when we disagreed on what that was. And my sister's always been good at math and science, and they didn't compare us. But it was always that encouragement to, you know, strive to be your best and think about what's around you and think about the people who are around you. And sorry, I know I'm supposed to be short, but you asked me a story. So my parents also really enjoyed camping. So we spent, you know, and my dad was in the military, so we moved around a few times. So we spent time outside. We spent time camping. We spent time hiking. And when we were overseas doing 5Ks. And so that idea of it being good for you to be outside, not just kind of the Southern idea of go outside and play. Don't be on top of a TV or something, but that idea that there's something good about being outside, there's something good about being around other people outside, that it's better for you, that this is the way we should engage as global citizens and as, you know, productive individuals, yeah, was something they kind of built in. Even when we were camping in the U.S. where there were fewer people of color, and kind of that balance between getting to know new people and making sure you're in a safe space, they kind of taught us the value of trying new things and exploring the world around you. And I think that really led to my career. They were also very connected to community. Wherever we went, wherever we lived, my dad just kind of became a big brother to people. My mom just kind of became a surrogate mom for people. Our house was always full on holidays because she cooked big for holidays, didn't know how to cook for just a small family on holidays. So I was always like exposed to people with different types of life. And when we were overseas, different cultures, my parents encouraged those experiences and learning about other people, not judging other people, being sympathetic to things that you don't understand about people's backgrounds. So I think, you know, the way that they welcomed people and continue to welcome people into their lives and try to encourage people to make better choices and to seek out other ways of thinking about the world really influenced me. And then for cancer, my mom's best friend was diagnosed with breast cancer. And that was kind of a whole experience for everyone who knew her. And then we thought she was healthy and recovered and great. And then she had a massive heart attack and passed away. And kind of instantly, the whole plan that we had always had, always pictured, changed dramatically. And, you know, people were like, oh, it's that chemo and stuff. It was like, it killed you. But the more I learned about cancer, the more I learned that, you know, you want to live, but there are also these other effects to these systemic therapies that we have to think about and have conversations about, even if we're still going to do the treatment, what might be some other things that we could do so people have more choices or are better prepared and things like that. And although my work isn't in communication, I do talk to survivors and kind of think through some things and try to be a resource of translating what people are Googling and seeing and that might be a Google trial into what might be useful.
Wow. Thank you. You've knocked out so many questions with just your robust response. Yay. But real quick, what part of the U.S. did you grow up in and how many siblings do you have? And what's your position?
Yeah. So I am the youngest. It's just me and my sister. It's interesting. She's the responsible, smart one.
Why would you say that about yourself?
I love it. People always react the same way, but like as soon as you see us together, it like makes sense. Because I'm much more flighty and emotional, and she's much more pragmatic and reasoned.
It's a firstborn thing.
Whenever we're together, I just default to not having to make any decisions.
It's a firstborn thing. You got to be put together.
It's excellent. I love that. That's her responsibility. Yeah. And with kind of moving, we've lived on the West Coast, the East Coast, and overseas because of my dad being military. And my parents encouraged us to learn about the places around us. So we did get some additional opportunities to travel, especially while we were overseas, and could take advantage of the fact of not having to buy flights.
What countries were they? What countries did you live in?
We lived in Germany. And because of it's nice and central, my parents had us explore some more of Western and Southern Europe while we were there.
Nice.
We were active in Girl Scouts, so we got some opportunities to travel through that as well.
Nice. I'll be in Germany in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, nice. Where?
Yeah. Cologne. Yeah.
Cool.
Looking forward to it. Anyways.
I want to go back because I know it's so different seeing it as an adult than as a child.
Yeah. So let's just talk about your work, right? You've done a lot in cancer, especially breast cancer. And we know it's the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women and women of color, especially Black women, tend to have worse outcomes when it comes to just mortality and, you know, survivorship outcomes, as it were. What would you say are some of the things you are exploring in your lab that really helps to address the disparities and with the hope of improving quality of life for this affected population?
Yeah, so I don't know if I'd say I have a lab, but not so makes me nervous.
But it is a lab, okay? Even if it's not physical, it's a lab. Hello, honey.
Maybe when I get tenure and associate like y'all.
Stop!
So one of the things that I found really interesting that I think is very concerning, not just that more aggressive tumors are diagnosed in women of color, but also that women of color, especially Black women, tend to be diagnosed earlier. So we tell this message, especially right now in October, that early detection saves lives and you should get a mammogram. but it's not available to a lot of women who, you know, based on insurance and the U.S. Preventive Task Force recommendations, many Black women are getting diagnosed before they're screening eligible. And that's a problem. And there are some discussions about, you know, well, are there certain populations that we should screen earlier? But for so many of us, that diagnosis happens without a known family history or without a known genetic mutation. And so what do we do about that? How do we learn more about how the risk factors that have been identified in other populations affect women of color? For example, a study that I was working on with the Black Women's Health Study, we're looking at parity and lactation and kind of confirming what other studies have found, that lactation can decrease the risk of triple negative breast cancer, ER negative breast cancer, which, you know, fewer therapeutic options for those, can often be more aggressive tumors. But there's increased risk with having children, but that increase can be kind of tempered with breastfeeding. So we know that breastfeeding is less common in women of color, that may be because of the jobs that we're working and what we are and aren't able to do. Support for breastfeeding versus encouragement to use formula, et cetera, that happens in the hospital, right? Mm-hmm. So it identifies something that's modifiable, that then we have a reason to invest in getting this message to women and figuring out intervention. So things like that. More of my recent work has really been transitioning research to think about survivorship, because so many Black women and women of color are diagnosed at earlier ages. We hopefully, prayerfully, have a longer time span as survivors. And there's a lot of gaps in terms of how do we make the most, like have the healthiest, best lives as much as we can during that period of time. And so focusing on exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and also personal care product use, and looking at sleep. Everybody feels better, works better, thinks better when they sleep better. So, you know, doing that as well as other collaborations I'm working on, looking at accelerated aging and cognition and frailty and other factors related to that. And I have an active collaboration that looks at exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and also personal care products use and risk of uterine fibroids, which we know definitely affects the quality of life for a lot of Black women.
Black women, yeah. So, and thanks for sharing that, by the way. I really, really learned a lot from that. In my country, Nigeria, it's the most populous Black nation in the world. So when I talk about like African women, I will use my country as a touch point because, you know, it's about the only country in Africa that I'm most familiar with. And we have the population to kind of back it up. So we can, well, within the degree of approximation, make some generalizations. There's been a spate of Black women getting diagnosed with aggressive forms of cancer, especially in our part of the world. You're talking about triple negative people in their 30s,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And even it's so bad, even the NCI recognizes it, right? I remember when I was a fellow at the NCI about 4 years ago, they had a particular section just addressing the burden of cancer in Africa. And in countries like mine, like Nigeria, we've had to battle a lot of contagious diseases like HIV and then tag on that, malaria. On top of that, we spend less than 5% of our GDP on health. So the infrastructure is super lean. We don't have a lot of robustness when it comes to healthcare delivery. And then the burden of communicable diseases and contagious diseases like HIV, malaria, has put a lot of strain on the dwindling, you know, healthcare resources. Now, because we're living longer, what do you think is responsible for these, you know, aggressive forms of care? Like, I can't count how many women I've had to help raise funds for and create awareness just to help support their treatment for breast cancer. And these are women in their 30s. What is going on globally? Why are we seeing more cases of aggressive forms of cancers, especially among Black women?
So first, I would say, girl, I do not know. If I knew,
you'll not be talking to me by now. Probably flying your jet away.
and so also because it's complicated, right? So anybody in what we've learned in cancer is that cancer is not one disease. Breast cancer is not one disease. We look at subtypes defined by tumor receptor status. And we find that, oh, wait, every tumor is actually very heterogeneous. So even though subtypes aren't accurate, aren't necessarily definitive, because you can have a really, really good therapy that kills off all the cells that respond, but then you're left with the cells that don't respond that have all this capacity to multiply, right? So it's like the more we learn, the more complicated it becomes. And so I would say, and we know that cancer primarily is a disease that's affected by an issue in cellular replication. Like that's the sign that, you know, whoever you believed designed people in the cells, it has a programming that says stop. And for some reason that programming isn't working. And so the cells keep replicating and making mistakes and sharing those mistakes, and it grows and outcompetes. So I think it's a combination of factors. Because I'm trained in environmental health, I think we've really need to spend more time thinking about environmental exposures in combination with other things, especially huge demographic, quick demographic changes, as well as stress, right? We all carry some of the stress that we've lived through, but also that generations before us have lived through epigenetic mechanisms. So I think there's, the epigenetics of stress, there's environmental factors, and the work that I'm doing and others as well, looking at chemical mixtures, because we're not exposed to just one thing, but how do we think about combinations of things that might light things up? There are a number of people who are looking at genetics. So with the hypothesis that there may be some genetic adaptations that were retained on the continent of Africa because of, the climate and the resources there that may have protect you against malaria, but may decrease may increase your risk of a certain cancer because of the biological mechanism. So it's not that you're Black. It's not that you're from Africa. It's this kind of adaptation of the population. So that's not my area of expertise, but it's kind of one of the things that people are talking about. One of the things that I think is interesting that it's not my area, but just kind of that I like to think out loud about is that when you have populations that have been dealing with infectious diseases, communicable diseases, then the immune capacity of the body has been very focused on resisting those reservoirs or resisting those challenges just to keep you alive. And I wonder if biologically with this, the hypothesis about allostatic load, this weathering, whether we exhaust or weather our immune capacity so that when we have an error, a cellular error or DNA damage doesn't get repaired because your immune system is so focused on these other things that seem like the red flags. And by the time you kind of get to things that could become cancerous, there just isn't as much reserve. So there, I don't know if there's any data on that. Those are just things that I think biologically. And then there are, some of the reproductive factors that we know are related to different cancers.
Yeah.
Like in terms of when people have children, how many children they have, do they breastfeed? We're learning a lot about men as well.
Yeah. I'm even hearing a lot about age of menarche, like whenever you start your period, like if you started too early and the impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we know that stress, environmental levels, factors, culture, there are a lot of things that affect diet, weight. Yeah. There are a lot of things that affect the age of menarche that can also be associated with cancer risk and the whole kind of metabolic and immunological milieu that our cells are just kind of hanging out in.
Yeah. I love that little shimmy dance you did there. which brings me to my next question. So there's a lot about a lot of things we cannot modify. So in our line of work, we look at modifiable and non-modifiable factors that really help, either characterize our risk factors, but also things we can improve on as far as interventions. So it seems you've already gotten us started by talking about stress and where we're from and what we eat and what we expose our body to. Now, what is the hope then? How do we minimize our risk for cancer? Like, what are some of the things you can start doing now, because October again is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on the podcast to really share some of your expertise on it. So what is the hope for I know prostate cancer is 1 in 6 men in their lifetime diagnosed with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. What's the stat for breast cancer? Is it 1 in 4?
1 in 8.
1 in 8. Okay, not too bad. So again,
one in 12.
Okay, it's still a lot better than prostate cancer. Prostate is 1 in 6, you know.
Yeah.
But that said, for some people listening to this, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, right? So yeah. The question I have for you is for two things. One is to even prevent ourselves from getting it. What are some of the things we can start doing now? And for those that have been diagnosed with breast cancer, because there's still future risk. Like you talked about your mom's best friend with that had like some other issues that came up. And then we also know that one of the risk factors for secondary cases of cancer is being diagnosed with cancer in the first time. Yeah, exactly. So how do we really maximize our life, as it were, on those both ends? So I'd like to ask you that.
Okay. So, and bring me back to the second question if I...
And I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask you 2 questions, but see, I have so many questions and I'm trying to honor your time, but yeah, I got you.
No problem. I could stay on for you. So I would say first, I would tell folks, do not panic. Everybody's body makes, you know, quote unquote mistakes, has to repair DNA. Everybody's affected by sun damage. Everybody has things that happen biologically. Most of the time, our body corrects those or gets rid of them, right? You know, your macrophages eat the cell so it can't reproduce or what have you, or, you know, the cell destroys itself, whatever, so that we don't necessarily develop a cancer. So I would say, I would also add, don't panic, because there are many cancers that stay indolent, may be diagnosed on autopsy, you might never know. And one of the things that we found with getting really, really strong, good screening tools is that you can end up with diagnoses that maybe never would have affected somebody's life.
False positives, yeah.
There can be false positives where it looks like a cancer, but it's not. And someone's kind of gone through that whole experience of thinking, oh God, I got cancer, I'm gonna die. Because we automatically panic. We don't really necessarily have in the public a consciousness of different stages and stuff. But also, you know, there are some cancers, even, you know, due to work in prostate, where sometimes the best thing to do is to watch and wait. Because maybe you'll never even notice, and maybe it'll never have an effect. So I would say start with don't panic. The second thing I would say is that for cancer prevention, it's the same recommendations for almost any health outcome. As much as we can, we want to eat healthy. We want to be active. I don't say exercise. I say be active, because for a lot of us, the lives that we live with our occupations or child rearing or whatever it is that you're not being able to drive everywhere, whatever it is that you do, stay active. And also I would add, you know, try to minimize exposure to toxins where you can. I'm working on detox in my life, but I really like smell goods. So I'm trying to make kind of better decisions about, you know, where is it really worth it to be exposed to certain chemicals or certain kind of hodgepodges in terms of what I can and cannot make decisions about. I would also add, have conversations about health where you can have them in a safe and healthy way. I almost said edifying. Because the more information we know about our family's well-being, our family's diagnoses, we can support them, they can support us, and we have information we need when we go into a clinical encounter. Many people don't want to go, if you have access to preventive care, use it. Many people don't want to go on a physical because it's like, oh, well, the doctor's just going to tell me to lose weight. Well, if you already know, then what are you losing?
Get ahead of it. Exactly.
You may as well go and let them, right? Not everyone has access, but if you have access, because you might learn something else, especially for folks that have a cervix, have a uterus. I'm always like, you know, you need a baseline. Mm-hmm. You need to have your pap smear or your HPV test so you know when something's different mm-hmm. before something's diagnosable, right? Mm-hmm. You can catch, especially for cervical cancer, if you can get rid of the in situ, get rid of the in situ before you have, right? We have this progression where we can intervene. Same thing for folks who are eligible for colorectal screening and have access. Go ahead and get it. The prep is terrible, I've heard, but do it. Because if we can get rid of the polyp, we might be able to prevent the cancer. So I would say take advantage of all of those opportunities. For folks that are from different cultures or in different places, I would say keep the positive things that you learn from your elders. There are many cases where our elders knew how to make a certain dish, and this is the one that helps your stomach feel better. Then 20, 40, 100 years later, you've got someone getting funding or having pharma tell you that, oh, well, this extract helps with the microbiome. Well, that is what generations of family have been saying you need when your stomach is upset, right? So when there are positive things, good things, keep those things. Teach them to your friends and your family. And really, I think if you have someone in your family, your friends, someone who's trying to live healthier, however they define it, encourage them and let them encourage you. We're starting to learn more about kind of social networks and how there can be these positive contagions where if someone decides to train for a marathon, it starts to ripple. Maybe other people don't train for a marathon, but maybe they start going out to walk, or someone's diagnosed with diabetes and they shift their diet. And then other people are like, well, you know, maybe in their network are like, oh, I saw you post pictures of that meal. It didn't look terrible. Why don't I? And there are certain shifts. Or when parents will decide, you know, they want to get pregnant. And so they start making all these changes in their lives.
Yeah.
You know, you get pregnant and then you undo them all. If it works for you, you found a way to make it work, hold on to what is feasible without stressing you out. So, and the second one was survival.
Oh, secondary cancers. Exactly. Yeah.
So one of my first recommendations to survivors is, probably will sound a little weird, is to sit in it. There will never be a time, and this like blew my mind when I thought about it, there'll never be a time where you're cancer naive. You'll never not have had cancer. Your identity is different. Your future looks different. It's scary. It's uncomfortable. For some people, it's rage inducing, but sit in it for a little bit and experience it. Don't try to race past it, and think about how does this change me, and how does it not change me? How does it change my plan for the future? How does it not change my plan for the future? How does it change how I relate to the people that I love and how they relate to me, and how does it not? Sometimes through the cancer journey, the dynamics of communication shift. Sometimes people keep things close because it's something they can control. And sometimes people like outreach a lot because they want that type of support. And think about, well, do I want it to stay that way or do I want it to shift? What do I like? Are there places of strength and resilience that I can find encouraging? If there are things that I'm struggling with, like for some people, like seeing your scars in a mirror is difficult. Well, what do I do about that? I can't unscar myself. I can't go back and not have surgery. But what might be something that makes me feel strong, makes me feel healthy? And how do I give myself grace through this process? Because there will be highs and lows, like just like for non-cancer affected folks. But how do I navigate that? And I say that first because the more we learn about stress, I would argue stress is out here killing people. Stress is a part of life. The whole, our body responds to acute stressors, chronic stressors, and the more chronic stressors we have, which we already know life is complicated. There's no one who really has an easy life. Then if you're a person of color, even if you live in a country where you're in the majority, there are still things that you're affected by in terms of, you know, discrimination and some of the pictures that we get from the broader global culture. If you're a woman or you identify as someone as a sexual gender minority, right? All these things can add up and you're kind of always doing these calculations. You're always adjusting. And sometimes you don't even realize how hypervigilant you are, but you react to something that someone else just barely realized happens. And that has a biologic cost. So that's why I start with experience what you're experiencing, and then you can make decisions about how you want to move forward instead of kind of scrambling to survive moving forward. You're surviving the cancer, even if you're like mid-treatment, because no patient fails a therapy. Therapies fail patients. And I know there are a lot of researchers and clinicians who don't have that language yet, but survivors need to hold that language. If you are getting up every day, if you're waking up every day, you don't even have to get out of bed. You're surviving. You're persevering, right? And sometimes there may be days where you don't want to function, and that's okay, because there will be another day. So that's why I say start with that. Next, I would say, as much as you can understand the implications of your diagnosis, find that out and be very... know it so well that you could have a conversation just like this with someone else. Not that you have to, but that means you really get it. So that when you are dealing with a doctor and they want you to make a decision, you have enough information to say, I'm not ready to make that decision. Can you give me this other information? How much time do I have to think about it, pray about it, look it up, whatever? And I think that can be really helpful in terms of being able to advocate for yourself, even when the right? Because sometimes clinicians and providers, they want to help as much as they can, but they can't make decisions for you.
Correct, yeah.
And they may not know what doesn't make sense to you. And if you don't already haven't already tried to process how you take in information, it can be hard to say, I don't understand, without feeling like, well, if I say I don't understand, they'll think I'm stupid, or they'll make the decision for me. Because it's such an emotional situation. Even when they're doing the best that they can, and you're doing the best that you can, it's still cancer. And then after that, I would say the same recommendations of trying to eat as healthy as you can, trying to be active, trying to sleep well, but also not trying to stress yourself out. I say start something small, get a win, do that, and then move on to the next thing that you feel comfortable with. And make sure that you have people in your life that you feel safe with, who you love and who love you, even if it takes time to do that.
Wow, those are very, very robust responses. And I just loved how you brought it full circle, right? I tried things we can do. Because I imagine that for those on the other side of the spectrum, for those who have been diagnosed and are trying to adjust to a new normal, there's this level of helplessness that comes with the cancer diagnosis that I've observed in my patients as well. But knowing that there's still some things within our control. And what is cancer? Something that is out of your control, right? Mm-hmm. But that there's still some things we can do. And for the other people, I love how you even emphasize baseline, right? The earlier you find some things, the better it becomes. I know people say, well, if I don't know, then ignorance is bliss. Not when it comes to cancer. As a matter of fact, your odds of surviving and living longer and living better, not just your lifespan, but also your health span, is early detection. And nothing beats that. And there's no way they can find that out, because a lot of the symptoms are so nebulous. Pain, fatigue, and God help you if you're overweight.
Weight gain.
They'll tell you, oh, go lose some weight, you know, and then come back, you know. So please establish a source of care. Have your primary healthcare doctor where you see once a year. Draw that blood, get your values.
Yeah.
Anything is off, please make that appointment right away. Don't. Yeah. I know there's a lot of fear, but a lot of us, we fear the outcome more than the issue itself, right? And yeah so thanks
and if
for
there's a baseline that gives you a chance to say, hey, I've off. Been here, I've had three physicals before here, and I've never had this much of a weight change.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't changed what I'm eating. I haven't changed how I exercise. This is a problem, right? And then that same clinician can go in your medical record and be like, maybe it's not, maybe I shouldn't necessarily make a quick judgment based on how you present, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because at least in the U.S. system, a lot of providers don't have a lot of time. So they have to try and be as efficient as possible, which in some cases does mean there are trade-offs for quality care.
Yeah.
At least, you know, or some of these kind of snap judgments or reliance on biases. And and there's not as much time to dig into, well, what's happening, as opposed to, well, patient's not compliant.
I know.
Patient is a no-show.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing, yeah. Which is what they have to do. It's not that people want to do that. Nobody gets into medicine to make a patient feel that way. So those are my always long-winded thoughts.
Thanks for sharing that. I forgot to ask this, if you can just briefly walk us through it. Between when you were nosy as a baby to now, can you just walk us through your educational pathway, especially how you got into research? Because I know you have a PhD, and so how did you get to this point of just, you know, doing what you do?
So it's interesting. Some people have a very like linear path, and even though I went straight through school, I did not. So I was in middle school, high school, something. And I decided that I did like a project for school and was learning about obstetric care. And I decided that I wanted to be a neonatologist. And my mom decided not to tell me that I couldn't, but instead she reached out to a hospital that was nearby and tried to see if she could find a neonatologist for me to meet. And so I got to go do like a little informational interview with a Black neonatologist, and he told me about his job and like saw his office and he showed me the ward and stuff. And it was a really, really amazing experience. And then I was like, Mommy, I don't think I can be a neonatologist. She was like, I didn't think so either. Right. So it was the patient side of caring for the patients and some of them not doing well that I realized I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So then because I took like Latin in high school, which is a whole different story, but
of course you did.
I wanted to take drama. There was like a whole thing. Yeah, I'll tell you APOs or something.
Not surprised.
So I was trying to decide what do I want to do next. I decided that, you know, I still want to do something useful. I think I want to go to law school and like be an environmental lawyer so that other people can go camping and feel safe and that people won't like poison places and stuff like that. So I wanted to go be a rabble rouser with a degree and still like making money. So I applied to several colleges, and I was super excited. I got into my first choice, and then my parents were like, we can't afford it. And then I was able to get a really nice financial aid package. And then they were like, well, you're too immature to live that far away from us. So so I went to a wonderful other school and decided I was going to major in poli-sci and public policy. I really struggled with econ. And I was taking a class in like intro to environmental science and policy, and I really, really loved it. And the primary instructor actually was like, I want to talk to you. And I was like, and she's now, I think she's provost or president or something at University of Chicago. So Marilyn Miranda, if you hear this,
yeah,
you're amazing.
Thank you.
So she was like, you know, have you considered changing your major? I think you would really enjoy doing this major in environmental science and policy. And so I looked at the requirements and were like, I don't know if I can do this. But then I changed majors and I got the BA instead of the BS so I could skip physics and orgo. And so I struggled through Gen Chem and calculus and got that degree. And as I was going towards the end, I'm like, you know, what do I really want to do? Do I really want to go to law school? I don't think I do. I think I really want to, I think I was taking like an environment and feminism class or something. And I was like, I want to help people. I want to work with people. And so I started looking around for, and I want my loans to stay in deferment. So I started looking around for grad programs and thinking, I mean, I got a good financial aid package, but still there's still things left over. And I found, you know, different master's programs, and I found an accelerated master's program and decided, like, this is accelerated. It's a master's in public administration, so it'll give me what I need to work with people, to work with organizations, to work with policymakers. Like, this is a really nice intersection, and it still has a really rigorous curriculum because you're still, like, doing some of the atmospheric bio-type stuff. You're doing policy. You're learning all this stuff. So it's, like, taking some of the skills that I have, adding and enhancing. I was like, this is perfect. I'll be out in a year and I won't be entry level in a place so I can really have impact. So I started that program and I took an elective in public in the School of Public Health and met Mary Northridge. And she was like, have you considered public health? And I was like, why? I mean, what I'm doing would improve public health. She's like, you know, you really might want to think about public health. So then I started looking at public health and was like, oh no, this is like the perfect intersection of everything I really
everything you're doing,
do.
Yeah.
So I started applying to PhD programs because she was like, you know, the way that you write, it seems like there are questions you want to answer. And I think, you know, if you get a PhD or some kind of training like that, you will learn how to answer your questions in a way that can help the communities you're interested in. And I was like, that sounds good. I'm going to write it in my personal statement. So I applied to some programs and I was like totally crushed because I only got into one of them and I won't name the others. I ended up starting the program, and they had just gotten a grant for a training grant for environmental epidemiology. And I didn't know that when I started. They probably said it and I wasn't paying attention because I was thinking about moving, having to move, and I was broke and stuff like that. So I started that program and I started doing epidemiology, and I was like, this isn't why I'm here. This isn't what I want. But I started to really like it. It was a challenge, but it was such a systematic approach. And I felt I could leverage it in a lot of different ways. And I still wanted to do environment. And I was kind of trying to figure out how to integrate those. And through a whole different situation, probably shouldn't record. My advisor left. I went there to work with two people and they both left before before I was done. But there was another faculty member who was like, you know, I'll take you on, I'll get you graduated. And I really struggled with the transition because I was used to my other advisor and I felt so safe and so comfortable because they also identified as coming from an underrepresented minoritized community.
Yeah.
And so just the vibes were so different. So we had some learning, some growing pains and some learning curves, but my second advisor, Mike McLean, who's still at BU School of Public Health, helped me figure it out, helped me write a grant to get my dissertation funded, and really, really supported me on getting the dissertation done. You know, when you graduate, you can do a lot of things, but you have to graduate. Even though he didn't always like understand why I was angry or crying or any of that. He was like, okay, well, like, what's the plan? What's the strategy? You know? And I think that was really helpful. Also in Gina Lithcott, who has since retired, fantastic, black woman who was, in administration at the time, who was like, look, sister girl, I'm gonna just tell you the truth. She helped me like navigate
sister girl,
that.
You know, when you hear sister like, girl, like, oh, it's going deep.
right. And so much of the unwritten curriculum, cause as far as I knew to that point, they hadn't graduated somebody black out of the program. So there were things happening that I didn't understand. And so she really helped me navigate the unwritten curriculum. To get going. And at that time I was having a big shift in my faith journey and trying to figure out, you know, who am I? Who is God? What do I want to do? What is good? And all this, and it's all happening at the same time. So through my F31 grant that I got, I started going into cancer because of one, this experience with my mom's best friend, and two, because those were the data that my advisor had, and really decided I liked doing cancer work. It felt like a hard outcome. It felt like it mattered. There were disparities. It was a complex etiology. And I was like, okay, this fits. This is where I'm going to be. As I was finishing, I was applying to a lot of postdoc programs because I was like, can't nobody afford to not have a job living in Boston? And I eventually had three offers for postdocs. I reached out to Deb Bowen, who's no longer with us, and she just gave me fantastic advice on how to navigate academia and how to think about who I want to be when I grow up and stuff like that. So then I started a postdoc at the Black Women's Health Study. And I learned a lot about minority health and health disparities. I learned a lot about, you know, study design, survey questions, writing grants. The project that I started on, I learned how to review medical records and abstract data. And so it just kind of got so many skills and tools. And I learned a lot about navigating the unwritten curriculum and the personalities and the biases and all the kinds of things, self-advocacy and failing forward. I learned so much that I tell other people not to be like me. but it really kind of solidified that this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm here. I can deal with the other things because this aligns with my purpose in terms of my career and how it connects to who I want to be and who I want to become, as well as how I want to interact with the world and the people around me. And so I worked there for almost 10 years, going from postdoc to like research associate and then to faculty, and decided that, you know, I'd gotten my K to really lean into cancer survivorship, decided that I wanted some other opportunities to develop independence in a different way, to figure out, you know, collect new data and stuff like that. And so I brought my K to Georgetown and have been exploring those different avenues within survivorship while continuing some of my other collaborations here to really kind of, yes, do risk. But now that we're having more and more survivors, which I'm so thankful for, let's figure out how to fill in some of the gaps to help people have enough information to make the choices they feel are best for themselves and their families.
Thank you so much. As we round off, I wanted to bring you back home, literally, how we met. So for those who are curious, so I met Tracy through the American Psychosocial Oncology Society, which is APOS. And this is a society dedicated to just supporting cancer survivors, you know, as a transition from even pre-diagnosis to survivorship and hopefully onto greater things. And they are made up of a lot of passionate individuals, ranging from psychologists to psychiatrists, to non-clinician, well, I'm a clinician, I don't practice, pharmacists, epidemiologists, like, you know,
Tracy, social workers,
advocates,
rehab therapists.
I mean, it's a whole board of, you know, healthcare providers who are just really passionate about the patients. And I'll tell you this about this organization. Going there felt like going home, you know. I go for conferences a lot, but there's something special about APOS. They put the junior faculty, the junior trainees first. First year in APOS, I was doing a plenary session. I'm like, and I done myself and Tracy was actually on the same session as Health Equity Scholars, like a whole keynote speaker. And I'm like, what? Yeah. But I'm just curious to know about your experience, Tracy. Just in a few words, how has APOS been like for you? And what do you really hope to get out of it? Because I know you're also part of the, you're leading the SIG right now with, you know, DEFCA. So just tell us a little bit about APOS and what you hope to get out of it.
Sorry, I'm like, I wasn't really like prepared for APOS question. APOS has been really interesting because of being an epidemiologist, a trained epidemiologist. My entry to APOS was related to my sleep intervention work because sleep has so many psychosocial as well as physical effects. And so, you know, I had a colleague who did the Health Equity Scholars program, and she said that she, you know, enjoyed the experience. And it's interesting you asked this because I'm like, you know, how long am I going to stay a member of APOS? I've been thinking about it. I mean, I'm going to the and thinking about, you know, how does it fit in with my career development? I had initially joined because I really wanted to kind of do some more networking collaboration to bring in more psycho-onc into my work and more expertise about biopsychosocial models. I haven't quite done that, but I have enjoyed the people that I've met and the things that I've done. And it has really been, like you were saying, a safe environment as a early-ish career person to explore different leadership opportunities. You very easily get invited if you want to review abstracts or you want to help with the program planning or you like, there are spaces to grow and spaces to learn without it being like having to become your identity. I also have found, like, compared to some of the other conferences and organizations I've been around, some of the ones that I don't attend anymore, is I haven't experienced it as cliquish. And I found that in certain circles, it can be hard to have opportunities for leadership when people, are cliquish, or they're kind of setting almost like academic nepotism, kind of setting things up for their trainees and mentees, which makes sense. Like, people can come to a conference and be comfortable and safe with the people that you're comfortable with, or making sure that your mentees and trainees are really set up for success. I'm not knocking it. It just wasn't something that really, really served me and I was really comfortable with. While at the same time, being in academia, being tenure track, like, you need to be able to add those leadership things. So there's kind of an intersection of needs and benefits there. And I totally have enjoyed the people that I've gotten to know, the other health equity scholars hanging out. And I've learned so much, especially about different areas of research and different communities to advocate for and consider in my work. You know, before talking with Kelly Irwin, I wouldn't have thought about, you know, are there ways to integrate folks diagnosed with severe psychiatric illness or mental illness in my work without having to exclude them? You know, me thinking, well, it's a sleep intervention. It could be very harmful to folks to change their sleep because it could trigger a psychiatric episode or increase suicide risk to consolidate or restrict sleep. I thought I was helping and protecting them from my intervention until actually having a conversation. But it took someone, right, who does that work to bring it to the fore. And we're working on a symposium. Delana and I are working on a symposium around disability and cancer and really kind of thinking in a different way. It's like, it's been such a safe space to think in a different way and draw different conclusions. And I've been so kind of encouraged by some of the work of other folks to kind of keep doing, especially with so many of my grants getting rejected. So it's been also been like a very encouraging space. I won't say that it's, you know, all rainbows and lollipops, because nowhere is, because people are complicated. But I definitely feel like in the time that I've spent there, this kind of season with it, it has been a positive experience. And it's one that I encourage others, you know, to at least try if they're eligible for the Health Equity Scholar yes. program, yes. at least apply and try it. And if you don't like it, you don't like it, but you've tried it, you've had an opportunity. You've met some really, really nice people who are really passionate about their work.
Thank you so much. And I think that's all of my questions because of the sake of time. Finally, would be, if there any words you'd like to close us with before we go? Maybe a call to action on our health or just anything you'd like to share before we go?
Oh, I'm so long-winded. So I would say, I don't know about a call to action. Right, the first time I'm speechless this whole like hour.
You're doing great, by the way.
A call to action. I would, maybe not a call to action. This is probably weird. But I would say one of the things that I already mentioned, but I would like to add to, is really to give yourself grace and to give grace to those around you. You know, every person that means well in life is doing the best that they can. And sometimes, especially when folks are dealing with a cancer diagnosis, you want to figure out the why. Or if someone has a loved one, especially a child, what did I do wrong? What happened? What do I fix? There's not always an opportunity to do that. At least in the U.S., more people are going to die due to cardiovascular disease than cancer, but cardiovascular disease doesn't scare anyone, right?
Yeah.
But some of the things that we would do to reduce risk of cardiovascular disease is the same as we would for cancer. Mm-hmm. So where you can find the win, take them and give yourself grace to not try and do everything at one time, but start small and build up. Start with what's feasible, what's capable. And that could be one switch at the grocery store until, you know, that feels normal, or one meatless Monday once a month, or whatever kind of you would want to start with and build on that, or one recipe substitution that still tastes close enough to what you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a conscious choice. Or when I talk with survivors sometimes, I'm like, you know, if that is your power lipstick that makes you feel like you can take on the world, wear that lipstick. but maybe there's some other product that you could find a less toxic alternative for. There is a cost to you not having the power lipstick, and it may not be worth the cost in terms of your way of functioning in the world and your mental well-being. It all matters. Your well-being matters, not just your health metric. So, you know, or maybe you switch out and use a less toxic cleaner in your house. Think about, where are the swaps that, you know, I'll notice, but it won't really hit, like, won't really hurt me. So then I don't resent it and undo it and, like, go beyond. So kind of take your time where you can, think through, give yourself grace, and take advantage of opportunities that are around you. If there's a social network that you have, you know, use those. If there is a program at the hospital you're at or at the place that you work that helps you increase your steps or make sure that you have access to preventive care, or maybe it will text you when you're overdue for something. Yeah. Whatever kind of makes your life easier, makes it easier to do those things, do those. If it's a friend and your birthday's around the same time and you have the same screening tests or similar screening tests, be like, okay, we are going to make on the same day, we're going to sit together and we're both going to make the call to book our colonoscopy, or we're both going to make the call to book our mammogram or whatever, to help each other. Or if it's, you know, two people who are partnered and both have certain screening tests, or both are eligible and have access to a physical, do that. Commit to it together to help each other when one of you wants to, like, renege or feels demoralized by something, a provider or a person at the, you know, sometimes it's not the provider, it's the intake person that gets you to sign that, right? So I'd say, you know, any of those things, because at the end of the day, you can be very healthy, but if you don't have well-being, we haven't really accomplished anything.
Some people
are healthy and robust and they're miserable, and that's not any good either. And that's really eating you out from, you know, causing you harm from the inside out. And that's something I'm still learning. There are seasons of suck, because, you know, that's adulthood, or that's sometimes difficult jobs or whatever, but that is not all of you. That's not your identity. That's not all of life. And so where those places where we can hold on to the light and be the light, and find our joy are huge, not just for our mental well-being, but also for how that mental well-being affects our biology.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. I've learned a lot about your work and just what drives your passion. And our story kind of intersects. I lost a father figure to prostate cancer, and that really followed my passion for just supporting men, especially Black men, as they undergo prostate cancer, but also even trying to encourage Black men to be more proactive about their health. I've also learned about just the importance of taking care of ourselves, you know, things we can do within our control. And I think that's really the hope in this month of October for those who might have been diagnosed with cancer, or those who are yet to be diagnosed, is that there's still hope and there's a lot we can do. So thank you so much for your time today and all you do. And I wish you the very best. And I can't wait to see you again next March. Yes. All right. Thanks a lot. Bye, everyone. And catch you on another episode of the podcast. This has been your girl.
Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome.